headlines, U.S. and Afghan officials say the U.S. military has left Bagram Air Base near Kabul, which has been the epicenter of the war in Afghanistan for nearly 20 years. The head of a major Iraqi parliamentary coalition says ousting American forces from the country is a national duty. And Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel's overnight bombing of the Gaza Strip will not undermine Palestinians' determination to fight the Israeli occupation. Top story for this half hour, the Afghan Defense Ministry says the U.S. military has officially handed over Bagram Air Base, located near the capital, Kabul, to the Afghan Army. The ministry said the Afghan Army will now protect the base and use it for combating terrorism. The base has been the epicenter of U.S.-led war on Afghanistan. Russia has reacted to the news by saying the withdrawal from Afghanistan must not turn into a redeployment of the NATO military infrastructure to a Central Asia. The Taliban have welcomed the pullout, saying the full withdrawal of foreign forces would pave the way for Afghans to decide their future. Some 9,600 remaining foreign troops should leave Afghanistan by September 11th. The deadline was set by U.S. President Joe Biden, who seeks to end America's longest war, which was launched in 2001. Amin Alami is joining us now by satellite from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Amin, welcome to the program. What can you tell us about the troop withdrawal from the Bagram Air Base, and why is Bagram so important?
U.S. sources as well as Afghan military sources here in Afghanistan confirmed that U.S. has officially handed over Bagram military air base in northern Parwatan province of Afghanistan to Afghanistan's defense ministry. According to a statement released by the Afghan defense ministry, this military base, Bagram military base, that was also known as the major U.S. military base in Afghanistan, is going to be used by Afghan military forces, mainly by the Afghan National Army troops. According to top military officials here, the Afghan National Armed Forces are enough capable to independently launch counter-terrorism operations and use military bases, including Bagram military base and Bastion military base in southern Afghanistan, to fully support Afghan armed forces on the ground to battle terrorism here. In the meantime, the Afghan government, as well as the Taliban militant group, both have welcomed the decision and have said that the pullout of Afghan foreign military forces from Afghanistan will help Afghans in order to discuss about the fate of their own country, mainly the controversial Afghan peace talks. In the meantime, the Afghan government also says that despite it is welcoming all military and non-military supports by the international community, but the Afghan government says that Afghan troops are ready to independently protect their own homeland and their own nation and launch military operations against terrorist groups inside Afghanistan. But a bitter truth, according to Afghan top officials, is that there are some foreign hands who are interfering in Afghanistan's internal affairs. For instance, the Afghan top officials, including Afghanistan's National Security Advisor Hamdullah Mohib, as well as the Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, and even former Afghan President Hamid Karzai, have repeatedly blamed Afghanistan's eastern neighbor, Pakistan, for interfering in Afghanistan's internal affairs, mainly by supporting terrorism and especially by supporting the Taliban militant groups and paving the way for them to launch terrorist attacks or bombings inside Afghanistan in order to gain its own national interests via destabilizing Afghanistan. But such claims or allegations have been repeatedly rejected by Pakistani officials in Islamabad. But let's not forget, Badia, that the withdrawal of foreign forces or handing over these military bases, mainly Bagram military base, to Afghan forces has also created some big questions. For instance, the critics of the U.S. war policy has said that most of military equipment have been destroyed by U.S. forces inside their bases before they leave these military bases across Afghanistan, including Bagram military base and, as I mentioned earlier, Bashan military base in southern Afghanistan. In such circumstances, the political and even military experts here urge the Afghan government to strongly back the public uprising fronts that have been created in recent weeks in order to fight against terrorists, mainly fight against the Taliban. They believe that supporting such military or local forces inside Afghanistan by the Afghan government itself will pave the way for the Afghan government to successfully defeat the Taliban militants and bring peace and stability to this country, or at least convince the Taliban militants to say yes to peace talks.
All right, thanks a lot. Amin Alimi, speaking to us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Elsewhere, the head of Iraq's Al-Fat parliamentary coalition says ousting American forces from the country is a national duty. Hadi Al-Amiri said the prosperity of the country is not possible if the U.S. maintains its military presence in Iraq and continues with implementing Zionist plans. He described the American presence as illegal, saying the government has a duty to throw out the occupiers. Al-Amiri also said that the request for dissolving the popular mobilization units is completely illogical, as they are a dignity of the country. Anti-American sentiments run high in the Arab countries since the U.S. Assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis last January. The Iraqi parliament then voted for the withdrawal of American troops from the country. Yemenis have held a protest in front of the UN office in the capital. They demanded the lifting of the siege and called on the international community to take action. Abdul Latif al-Washani has more in this following report.
Yemen's Ministry of Electricity held a sit-in protest in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to call on the international community to step in and to pressure Saudi Arabia to stop detaining Yemeni oil vessels. The ministry said it is unable to generate power anymore due to the lack of fuel.
Electricity is an essential service and has nothing to do with any political conflicts. The power sector in Yemen has been heavily affected since the first moment of the war. The Saudi-led coalition has directly targeted all electric power plants, and this is a great tragedy for us. The UN has not done anything to end the suffering of Yemenis. We demand the lifting of the siege and releasing the oil ships so we can generate electricity again.
At the same place, Yemeni children organized a gallery for the drawings. The gallery was named The U.S. Kills Our Childhood and exhibited children's drawings that show the suffering of Yemeni children due to the ongoing conflict.
We participated in this protest to tell the United Nations, which classified Ansarullah in its blacklist of groups violating children's rights. We Yemenis demand our rights like any other people, on top of which is the lifting of the siege imposed on us by Saudi Arabia.
How many fathers and mothers have lost their children? This is a massive crime. This is tyranny. We are little children. We have no fault.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on the impoverished country in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and imposing an all-out blockade.
Yemenis have held hundreds of protests in front of the United Nations office, but the international body has not yet taken any strict measures to end the suffering of the millions of Yemenis. That is why the UN describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Elsewhere, Hamas has reacted to the latest Israeli attack on Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement says Israel's aggression would not affect the determination of the Palestinian nation to fight for their rights. Hamas spokesman Fazi Barhum called the Israeli attack a cover-up for the regime's increasing challenges. He said the attack is a show to appease what he called Zionist settlers. Barhum stressed that resistance groups would confront Tel Aviv's hostile policies and would make it respect Palestinians' rights. On Thursday night, Israeli airstrikes hit areas south of Gaza City. Tel Aviv claimed they were in response to Palestinians sending incendiary balloons toward Israel. In May, the regime launched 11-day aggression against Gaza, killing nearly 260 Palestinians. Israeli forces have clashed with Palestinians protesting against an illegal settlement outpost near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The clashes erupted on Sabia Mountain. In the town of Beita, the Palestinian protesters were calling for the removal of Eviatar settlement outpost. The outpost has become one of the focal points of clashes between settlers backed by regime forces and the Palestinians. Several Palestinians have been killed and dozens wounded in the violence over the past several weeks. The Israeli authorities decided to remove the Eviatar settlement to turn it into a military base pending a new decision. However, the Beita town residents rejected the decision and pledged to continue their protests until the outpost is removed. In Indian-controlled Kashmir's Srinagar, a young man has returned home after spending 12 years in an Indian jail. The man walked free after all the charges pressed against him were proven to be false. Our correspondent, Shahnabad, reports from Kashmir.
Bashir Ahmed Baba is a free man now. 12 years back, he was detained at the Gujarat state of India for a crime he was unaware of.
I used to work for a German-based NGO. I and my colleague, who was non-Kashmiri, had gone to attend a training workshop on children with disabilities. It was a two-week-long program, but I was detained on the sixth day while my colleague was set free.
Baba was detained under a controversial Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, or UAPA, and was accused of making bombs in soft drink cans.
I was unaware of what I was being questioned about. I even couldn't read the charge sheet because it was in the local language. But one thing I was sure about is that one day I would walk free because I knew I was innocent. But I never knew it would take 12 years to prove it.
Unlawful activity is defined vaguely in the law as any action, whether by an individual or an association, which disclaims, questions, disrupts, or is intended to disrupt the sovereignty and territorial integrity of India, or causes or is intended to cause disaffection against India. According to the National Crime Records Bureau data, there's a rising graph of UAPA cases in Jammu and Kashmir. The UAPA law has come under stern criticism after several activists and journalists in India were booked under it by the Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi-led Bharatiya Janata Party. Scores of Kashmiris are languishing in the jails across India. Providing legal aid and frequent meeting with the prisoners has become a challenge for their families.
In these 12 years, I have seen him once, that only after I sold my gold earring. We were drained financially after his father died of cancer, so going to him was out of our bounds.
Analysts say unlawful detention is a violation of human rights, and the covenants of civil and political rights say such people need to be compensated for unlawful detention, and for those who have falsely implicated them also need to be tried in the name of malicious prosecution.
In India, in case of Muslims in general and Kashmiris in particular, the law enforcing authorities have been given a license to harass, implicate and detain without any cause. That is why we find Muslim population in India is just 15%, whereas 35% prisoners of India are Muslims, and most of them are falsely implicated.
Sheikh added, Kashmir is an exceptional case where New Delhi has placed laws that allow authorities to detain people without any reason. Baba is happy to be back and is rejoicing the reunion with his family members. However, is in a constant dilemma where and how to start fresh. Shahnabad, Indian Administered Kashmir.
India's total deaths from the pandemic have surpassed 400,000 after the country registered more than 850 fatalities in the past 24 hours. India also reported over 46,600 new cases during the same period. The total is now above 30.4 million there. The country witnessed a surge in COVID in April and May. That pushed daily cases there above 400,000 in May. A new variant called Delta, which is highly transmissible, was identified afterwards. The strain has been reported in dozens of other countries too, causing flare-ups and prompting new curbs. On Friday, South Korea's daily case count topped 800, the highest there in nearly 6 months. Thailand also reported record deaths for a third straight day, with 61 fatalities. And Russia has reported 679 more coronavirus deaths in the past 24 hours, setting another record of fatalities for the fourth straight day. This comes as Russia is struggling with the surge in COVID cases that authorities blame on a more contagious Delta variant and a lagging vaccination drive. Despite a rise in cases and deaths, the government says it would not impose a new lockdown. President Vladimir Putin this week, however, urged Russians to get vaccinated. The government had set a goal of fully inoculating 60% of the population by September, but officials now say they would not be able to meet that target. Russia has recorded over 136,000 deaths from the virus and over 5.5 million cases. Canadians gathered to honor the victims of survivors of the country's church-run residential school system, which have brought down the statue of Queen Victoria in Winnipeg.
No pride in genocide!
The crowd chanted slogans against the killing of over 4,000 children as the statue fell outside the provincial legislature. A nearby statue of Queen Elizabeth II was also pulled down. That's on Canada Day, which is celebrated traditionally as the National Day. This year's celebrations were muted amid growing anger over the discovery of the remains of hundreds of children in unmarked graves at the sites of former Indigenous schools. Many cities scrapped the events and held vigils and rallies commemorating the country's dark colonial history. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
New York prosecutors may soon bring indictment against Trump Organization tied to perks for top executives, says David Smith, author, in an article published under the heading Trump in Financial and Political Danger as Company Faces Possible Criminal Charges. Stay tuned for more. Donald Trump is facing a potentially crippling financial and political blow as the state's prosecutors consider filing criminal charges against his family business recently. Prosecutors in New York could soon bring an indictment against the Trump Organization related to the taxation of lucrative perks that it gave to top executives, such as use of apartments, cars, and school tuition. The 45th president is not expected to be personally charged, but the legal drama could bankrupt his company by damaging its relationships with banks and other business partners, as well as clouding his political comeback. Ron Fischetti, a lawyer for the Trump Organization, held a virtual meeting with prosecutors recently for about 90 minutes in an effort to dissuade them from pursuing criminal charges against the company. The charges are absolutely outrageous and unprecedented. If needed, the charges are filed, Fischetti told the Associated Press recently, adding, this is just to get back at Donald Trump. We are going to plead not guilty and we will make a motion to dismiss. Fischetti and his colleagues had to make their final arguments against charges being brought, according to a report in the Washington Post. The long-running investigation by Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan district attorney, began after Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, paid hush money ahead of the 2016 presidential election to two women who alleged that they had sexual encounters with Trump. Trump denies the claim, however. There is now a particular focus on Alan Weisselberg, 73, the longtime chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, the private real estate conglomerate. Prosecutors are examining his son Barry's use of a Trump apartment at little or no cost, cars leased for the family, and tuition payments made to a school attended by Weisselberg's grandchildren. Such gifts and perks are worth tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. If the Weisselberg failed to account properly for that money on tax returns and other financial filings, they could be in legal jeopardy. But Fischetti insists that any criminal charges based on fringe benefits would represent a speculative break from precedent. We looked back 100 years of cases, and we haven't found one in which an employee has been indicted for fringe benefits, and certainly not a corporation, he told the AP, adding, to be a crime, it would have to be for the benefit of the corporation with the knowledge of the corporation. They don't have the evidence at all. Even so, a point of intrigue is whether Weisselberg will remain loyal to the former president or turn informant, potentially testifying against Trump, the company's owner, his son Don Jr. and Eric, who are executive vice presidents, and his daughter Ivanka. Trump, beaten by Joe Biden in last November's election, has long sought to dismiss the investigation as a witch hunt and remains politically active. He returned to campaign rallies, intends to be heavily involved in the 2022 midterm elections, and could run for president again in 2024. But there are signs that the walls are closing in. Vance, investigating possibly extensive and protracted criminal conduct, has been scrutinizing Trump's tax records, subpoenaing documents and interviewing witnesses, including Trump insiders and company executives. A grand jury was recently paneled to look at the evidence. Meanwhile, Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, said she was assigning two lawyers to work with Vance on the criminal investigation while she continues her own civil investigation of Trump's business. James' office has been examining whether the Trump Organization inflated the values of some properties to obtain better terms on loans and lowered their values to obtain property tax breaks. Court records show some overlap between Vance and James' separate investigations, including their interest in Seven Springs, a 212-acre estate outside Manhattan that Trump purchased in 1995. James is examining a $21.1 million tax deduction taken when Trump agreed not to develop the property after local opposition thwarted his plan to build a golf course, and a separate plan to build luxury homes was shelved. Trump has angrily denounced both investigations. In a statement released recently, he claimed the case was an extension of the Democrats' witch hunt against him. "They will do anything to stop the MAGA movement and me," he said, referring to the Make America Great Again campaign slogan, and insisting that the Trump Organization had merely done things that are standard practice throughout the U.S. business community and in no way a crime. The ex-president added, having politically motivated prosecutors, people who actually got elected because they will get Donald Trump, is a very dangerous thing for our country. In the end, people will not stand for it. Remember, if they can do it to me, they can do it to anyone, unquote. Trump's loss of power in Washington now deprives him, his family, and his company of legal protections he enjoyed while in the White House. The District of Columbia Attorney General's office, for example, is suing the Trump Organization and Presidential Inaugural Committee over the alleged misuse of more than $1 million for use of event space at the Trump Hotel in Washington during Trump's inauguration in January 2017. Ivanka, who was a senior advisor at the White House, sat for a deposition with investigators last December, but is in no imminent danger of criminal charges.
We the people.
U.S. healthcare.
According to official estimates, there are around 30 million people without health insurance in the United States. There is no universal healthcare program, and health insurance is mostly just another product set to be marketed and sold in the free market.
Imagine you're in America. Which of these options would be best for you?
That's a lot to think about.
What is it? An oop max?
I guess with what I got here, I would go with Plan D because the deductible is zero.
Okay, there's more.
Gold HMO, PPO, PPO, HMO.
And what are copays? I don't get... That's like if you pay for Spotify Premium, and Spotify still makes you pay every time you listen to a song.
Welcome to We The People. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi, and in this episode, we will take a look at the controversy at the heart of healthcare in the United States. We will also delve into the issue of insurance, which is a profitable business and therefore plays a major role in the politics of the United States.
You know what the major problem with American healthcare is? It's paperwork.
Are you kidding me? 10 or 12 pages? V-O-H-C. Do I have any glasses?
Going to check right now.
Shit.
Excellent.
Okay, let's talk about Obamacare.
We will. Sure? Yeah.
All right, let me just take a look here. A typical insurance on an initial visit like this, which takes me 1 hour, pays about $100 or $95. The cost of that hour for me to just keep the office open and operating is about $300.
So when insurance is actually paying for it, they're not paying you enough.
They pay me a lot less than the visit is worth.
Healthcare coverage is mostly provided through a private health insurance. There is, of course, the limited public health coverage, such as Medicare and Medicaid. Efforts to get the country closer to a comprehensive healthcare program have all been shut down by those promoting the idea that healthcare should also be subject to competition in the market. But is healthcare something the people want the government to provide, or is it something to shop for?
What do you think about socialized healthcare?
I do not like the idea of that.
I don't want the government picking what I can and cannot do.
Well, my husband's from Europe, so I think it's pretty good, actually. I think a lot of people are covered by it. Everybody's covered. They don't have to worry about paying for it.
It's definitely more accessible for everybody. It allows all of us to remain healthy, to live long lives as much as we can.
I think it's kind of a necessity that the government provides healthcare for its citizens.
If everybody has something for free, who's going to pay for it?
Okay, what if people pay for it by taxes? What do you think of that?
Well, that's going to increase. You like to pay taxes?
Regardless of where the everyday American stands on the issue, a never-ending political debate is underway to address the matter. And of course, as always, some power play is also at work. Our first guest is Dr. Anna Malinov, a clinical professor of pediatrics at the University of California and the co-organizer for the Working Group for National Single Payer Healthcare. Welcome to the show, Dr. Malinov.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. First of all, generally speaking, do you think healthcare is a right or is it a product open to competition in the free market?
Well, there are two ways to answer your question. Do I believe that healthcare is a human right? Yes, I strongly believe this. But generally speaking, is healthcare considered a right in the United States? And I would have to say, sadly, that it is not. A right cannot be based on your ability to pay, as is the case here. A right cannot and should not be based on your race or on your class, and that is the case here.
Very well. Thank you for your insight, Dr. Malinov.
Today, the United States remains with no universal healthcare program, unlike most other developed countries. Therefore, it ranks only among the first 30 countries when it comes to healthcare access and healthcare quality. With prices specified in the open market, costs for medicines and healthcare depend on market forces rather than the government. In the other developed nations, however, there are governmental programs aimed at partially controlling costs relating to healthcare.
What's an average medical bill for, you know, a regular Texan? How much might that person be paying for their premium and their regular bill?
Let's say you break your arm. Regularly in the rest of the world, that's a couple hundred dollars. Here in Texas, easily $2,000, $3,000.
Could I ask you then to guess how much it might cost in the UK if you broke your arm, that situation? How much do you think someone has to pay in order to have that fixed?
$200.
It's totally free.
Totally free. Wow.
I can tell you. I've got a busted shoulder, and I can tell you exactly how much it cost.
Do you mind?
Yeah, sure. It was $5,000 just to have a doctor look at my broken collarbone. Just
right.
To look at my broken collarbone.
And you had to pay that on arrival?
No. My insurance covered the majority of it, but my portion of it was about just shy of $3,000.
Wow.
So if you ask the people, many would complain about the expensive costs of healthcare in their country. Hospitals, doctors, and nurses charge more, and if the costs are on the rise due to market forces, the government is in no position to have a say. We're now joined by Life Malcolm, a community organizer based in Tampa, Florida. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, as a developed nation, why does the United States still lack the universal healthcare system?
So that's very interesting kind of question. Whether it's a right or something in the, you know, competition in the free market, it's a really dynamic question. And I say that because I don't know if there's, you know, if it's a right or not. Maybe it is, you know, because rights seem to presuppose somebody's authorization of the occurrence or something. But what I do know is healthcare is a necessity.
Very well. Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Life Malcolm. Stay tuned as we have more.
Lack of healthcare was particularly tough during the COVID-19 pandemic. Over 30 million cases of the novel coronavirus have so far been reported across the United States. And 600,000 Americans have died due to COVID-19 infection.
The emergence of the Delta variant, which has now been found in many states across the United States, does pose a challenge to our collective efforts to squash COVID once and for all. That being said, we need not react to the Delta variant. We can act now. Thankfully, the vaccines that we have available have shown great effectiveness against, including the Delta variant. The best thing that folks can do right now who are concerned about this is take the clear step of going out and getting vaccinated and keeping themselves and their families safe.
The Delta variant of the coronavirus is rapidly spreading across the country, so much so that it will likely become the dominant COVID-19 strain in the United States, according to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. A higher percentage of all new doses are expected to be from the Delta variant, which first appeared in India and is now rapidly spreading across the world.
Healthcare has always played a significant role in politics in the United States. And if you look at the last few electoral cycles in the United States, healthcare has been most prominent in the electoral politics. And when polled, most Americans support expanding Medicare for all. Yet politicians who are put into office by those very same companies that make a huge profit from the healthcare system are the ones that are writing policy. And they are the ones that are not writing the policy that we need and that we deserve in this country for single-payer Medicare for all. So if it's up to the politicians, we'll never achieve single-payer national health care. That's why it's up to us, the people, to make it happen.
While the majority of Americans have been vaccinated, vaccine hesitancy remains a serious issue. Some would assume now that with the vaccinations continuing, the rates of infection would automatically drop. Yet, in reality, a whole lot is left to be studied about the Delta variant, and some reports warn that it could even result in a rise in the number of doses come this fall.
This variant is probably 40 to 60% more infective, more contagious than the 117 variant, that UK variant that became prevalent in the United States and caused that surge in the late spring. It doesn't necessarily appear more pathogenic, meaning more dangerous, but it's infecting people more easily and is starting to become very prevalent in the UK in communities that are unvaccinated. Connecticut, for example, where I am, shows no upsurge of infection, but Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Missouri show very substantial upsurges of infection. It's based entirely on how much population-wide immunity you have based on vaccination.
There are myriad conspiracy theories out there which disagree with the use of vaccines for a variety of reasons. Even before the pandemic hit, the opponents of vaccination, commonly referred to as anti-vaxxers, were active. Today, they could create a crisis for the uninsured people.
seem to presuppose somebody's authorization of the occurrence or something. But what I do know is healthcare is a necessity, right? People need to be healthy, and people certainly in the United States, right, where we have food deserts and all kinds of malnutrition, poor agriculture, et cetera, you know, where disease is rampant, and especially in poor and African communities, we need oftentimes other people to take care of us. So, you know, whether it's a right or not, I don't know if that's the fundamental question. As a matter of fact, I would say it's not. It's a necessity. It's an absolute must. And if we define right as a must, as a necessity, then yes, it's a right. And but I don't know what the definition of right is for this particular conversation. But I also want to say to the question of competition, it's you know, when you're talking about colonialism and the United States of America that's built on colonial capitalism, everything is commodified. Chairman O'Malley used to tell talks about this saying where the capitalist will sell you the rope to hang them with. So everything in the United States of America is commodified and in that way set up for some kind of competition. But healthcare is an absolute must and a necessity.
The higher transmissibility of the Delta variant could complicate the situation in the United States, where some still refuse to get vaccinated. As of June 18th, over 45% of Americans had been vaccinated, and some 54% had received the first dose.
The ingenuity of American scientists, the full capacity of American companies, and the whole of government response across federal, state, tribal, and local governments. Together, we built an unparalleled vaccination program and managed one of the biggest and most complicated logistical challenges in American history. And above all, we got here because of the American people stepping up and getting vaccinated, helping family, friends, neighbors get vaccinated. And just remember what the situation was like 150 days ago. We didn't have enough vaccine supply for all Americans. We didn't have the vaccine infrastructure, or the people who administer the vaccines, or the places where the people could get vaccinated. But we turned it around together by acting quickly and aggressively and equitably.
More costly healthcare processes are on the horizon for many Americans. The ups and downs of the vaccination effort indeed plays a major part in the lives of those not enjoying any insurance coverage, as well as many who are confused whether to opt for a public or private option.
The reason why the United States of America does not have some kind of a system that cares for subjects, colonized people like Africans, like the indigenous people and others who are here based on the terms the United States set for us, the colonized, is because the colonizers exist on the whole existence is based on that exploitation. So, yeah, they are, if you will, the United States is developed, but their development depends, the sole existence of the development depends on the United States and the colonizers' ability to exploit and oppress those of us who are colonized, which means that they don't care whether we're sick if our sickness does not hurt their ability to maintain colonial power. So, you know, right now, the United States has this situation in place where they make money off of our sickness, and they don't, whether we suffer from illness or not, doesn't hurt them.
Not having health insurance has made the pandemic harsher for many in the United States. Therefore, there are those who believe that healthcare is a right for every American, rather than a commodity and insurance. They argue that healthcare is not a privilege, rather it is a right that everyone should enjoy.
Show me your room.
Luca was born with alveolar capillary dysplasia and Hirschsprung's disease. At 3 weeks old, he had surgery to remove part of his colon. At 2 months, he went into cardiac arrest, and at 5 months, he had a lung transplant. His parents had to turn to fundraising almost immediately just to keep up with the medical bills.
They did a clamshell approach, and he has several scars from all of the other surgery.
So when did the U.S. healthcare system go from a philanthropic program to a multi-billion dollar industry? And where do the funds go once the bills are paid?
No one should die due to not being able to cover the financial costs of healthcare, and everyone should have access to the health services they need. Many believe that in the United States there is a system at work designed to deny rather than support the right to health.
Liberals and conservatives both believe in liberty. And how can you be free if your health care depends on your employment? Both believe in economic freedom. But how can you be free if medical debt is the number one cause of bankruptcy in the country? Now, both liberals and conservatives believe in a fair shake. But how can you believe in the system that does not include a level playing field and that relegates children who are poor to a second tier of healthcare from the time that they're born? And finally, both believe in equal opportunity. How can you have this if you are a sick person who suddenly is too sick to work, and then you lose your job, and then you lose your health insurance, and then you can no longer help you yourself and fend for yourself or help your family? So I believe that everyone in this country, liberal, conservatives, and everyone in between, believes that we should have healthcare that is based on need and not on your ability to pay, and that is universal, comprehensive, affordable, accessible, equitable, and just.
Some U.S. states have been obliged to move forward with the universal care coverage, most notably Minnesota, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. The Affordable Care Act, or the so-called Obamacare, was also among such efforts with myriad ups and downs, from rejection in the Trump era to partial survival in the Biden administration.
2 years of campaigning, and I'm telling you, no matter where I went, people were suffering so badly with the ravages of Obamacare. And I will say this, that as far as I'm concerned, your premiums, they're going to start to come down. We're going to get this passed through the Senate. I feel so confident. Your deductibles, when it comes to deductibles, they were so ridiculous that nobody got to use their current plan, this non-existent plan that I heard so many wonderful things about over the last 3 or 4 days after that. I mean, I don't think you're going to hear so much right now. The insurance companies are fleeing. It's been a catastrophe, and this is a great plan.
Donald Trump promised to repeal Obamacare, but the health insurance survived his repeated attacks. The former president enjoyed support in both chambers of U.S. Congress and even assigned Supreme Court justices, poised to overturn the insurance program, but all to no avail.
So the truth is that Medicare for All would not have prevented the COVID-19 pandemic. Many, many other countries that did have or do have universal health care still suffered terribly from the pandemic. But it would have gone a long way to help people here in the United States. So we do know that more Americans died from COVID than any other country in the world, and all countries that spend less on healthcare than we do. Now, if the United States had a national single-payer healthcare system, there are some things that would have been different during the pandemic for sure.
The U.S. Supreme Court, which appears to have the ultimate say over the issue, has so far refused to strike the ACT down, despite getting very close to it. Two of the three jurists Trump had appointed to the High Court, namely Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, voted as part of a 7-2 majority to deny claims that the law harms some states.
Majority Leader.
Ever since Democrats passed the Affordable Care Act, expanding health coverage and access to tens of millions of Americans, we've had to fight tooth and nail to preserve the law from partisan Republican attacks. For more than a decade, the assault on health care law was relentless from Republicans in Congress, from the executive branch itself, and from Republican attorneys general in the courts. In a landmark vote, we in the Senate prevented the Republicans from repealing the ACA in 2017.
After all, the Supreme Court had ruled in a 5-4 decision that Obamacare individual mandate is constitutional in 2012. With more liberal justices sitting on the bench at the time, the decision basically meant Americans would be fined through paying taxes if they did not apply to purchase health care insurance.
Republicans, Democrat, Republican, what have you, they don't have the ability to say that colonized people, African people, have our own particular needs. We have our own particular, as a matter of fact, you will hear mayors, governors, and maybe sometimes even presidents say stuff like, they are the president for all the people. You know, they don't see color, stuff like this. The reality is, because those types of sentiments and that type of blindness exists among liberalists and conservatives, conservativists and what have you, African people and colonized people need to be able to do for ourselves what those blind people cannot and will not do.
With the U.S. health insurance struggling to exist in the face of opposition from many conservative factions, the U.S. government needs to put more focus and attention on this issue. The pandemic is taking fewer lives, but the vaccination is also lagging. The U.S. has been boosting the vaccination effort by offering incentives from free hamburgers to college scholarship.
That's something in our history, in our DNA, that we desire to be free from government intervention in our lives.
From your perspective, you know, what's the vaccine choice debate about?
A parent should have the ability to decide whether or not their child takes medicine or receives an injection. It's about liberty.
So it's not about the vaccines themselves or their safety?
For some it is. For me personally, it has nothing to do with the science or debating the science of vaccines.
Do you get vaccines yourself?
I do.
Do you have children?
I do. And they've been vaccinated.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up getting the flu shot every year.
Mm-hmm.
It's purely, but it was at my own choosing.
But even million-dollar lottery prizes are failing to convince the hardcore anti-vaxxers to get vaccinated, which could endanger the lives of others, particularly those with pre-existing conditions. As healthcare just becomes more important, the authorities are under more pressure to provide for the nation in the critical sector. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Please tune in again next week when we come back with another episode of We the People.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.